So I was already leaning toward this idea of six people. And one of the reasons I went to six people is a funny comment by Tom Peters, who said a team, a work team, should be no larger than who can be fed with two large pizzas.
I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Tightrope Podcast. We tell the stories of people who are defining the future of work. Our guests walk the tightrope, away from meaningless toil, and towards work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell, and the insights that they provide, will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. This week, we bring back to the tightrope our guest, Dr. Dan Hill. He is a nationally recognized expert on facial decoding, a practice which allows people to understand what others are thinking and feeling. Now, Dr. Hill is working on a program that we think will revolutionize how people engage on Zoom and in other group work settings. He is using learning pods, which are groupings of six people, to deliver content, develop critical skill, facilitate teamwork, and foster leadership. We think that Dr. Hill's learning pods will definitely influence the future of work in a positive way. We also discuss Dr. Hill's latest book writing project. It's called The Devil's Dictionary of Work Life, and it's a humorous examination of work terms that have bubbled up during the pandemic. We spoke with Dr. Dan Hill last week over Zoom. Dr. Dan Hill, welcome back to the tightrope.
Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. Good to see you, my friend.
Absolutely.
So before we get into your latest work, which is totally intriguing to me, I wanted to first ask you about facial coding, which was the topic of our last conversation. With so many people working virtually, have we gotten better at decoding facial expressions on Zoom, or have we gotten worse?
Hard to say. I don't have any empirical data, but I suspect it could be actually worse. And I say that because a lot of people are feeling despair at this point. We're many months into this. We're nowhere near the end. We don't know when the end is going to come. Sadness as an emotion slows you down both physically and intellectually. So, you know, the upside could be, yes, empathy, and you're caring more. But I think there's a real possibility here that people could slide from despair into solipsism and just kind of slide away from the picture. So I would not be optimistic as to the answer to your question. And then in general, I have to admit that I don't think people are terribly good at utilizing visuals. We just don't tend to go there very well. We should. About 77% of how we take in the world is visual. 18% is hearing. And then you've got, you know, small fry left for the other three senses. So we should absolutely be leveraging visuals. But I think we tend to go with the words. We want to believe what we're being told because it's the easier, softer route. So no, I can't say I'm optimistic.
Is there anything that we should be doing now in our interactions that we're not doing?
Well, I think that if on the conference call, if they enable it, that the speakers, you know, video screen can go larger. I mean, if you got, let's say, God forbid, nine people on the call, and it's like the old game show Hollywood Squares, that makes everyone pretty hard to relate. So I think if you can see the face larger, then despite the buffering and the time lags and the other things that technology can impose on us, then you at least have a chance to see the expressions more vividly, the close-up, so to speak. I think that would aid things, or at least having two people back and forth. I mean, we naturally work in terms of dialogue, but we end up with all these soliloquies online. And I just think it sends us down the rabbit hole.
I'm following the advice of another guest of ours, Adrian Schock. She's a neuroscientist. And what she said to me is try to set up your screen to approximate what it would be like if you were face to face with that person. And right now I'm looking at you and you're not totally in my grill, but you're at a comfortable distance, and I'm hopeful that I am for you as well. And I have to say that because of that, Zoom has been a phenomenal tool for me in my podcast. I can read your facial codes and I can see if I ask you a question and it's like, oh, swing and a miss. Or, okay, he gets it. I didn't embarrass myself.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, I love Zoom and I think it can draw us toward the face, but I don't think I'm the only person who's also intrigued by what's in the background for people. You know, I am taking in their artwork, their books, the decor. Are they living in a house, apartment? Is this a vacation home? I had one person recently told me that she was on a conference call with her boss, and to her complete surprise, she noticed he had a bong on the shelf behind him. So she suddenly learned a lot more about her boss than she'd ever known before.
Oh my goodness. Well, maybe it was a relic from college.
Perhaps. Or his son's, wink, wink. Yes, not his.
Right. Well, you know, there's a group on Twitter called Room Raider, and they rate the rooms of people they see on TV during, you know, the Zoom sessions that broadcasters have to rely on because they can't get people in the studio. And it's really interesting to see what they say. I'm living in tight quarters, so it's a little difficult for me. I got fine art hanging behind me, but you're not seeing what's below the fine art. Thank God. It's a bloody mess. So let's talk about your latest work because it really intrigues me. You are facilitating learning pods in the teaching profession. My wife is a teacher. They call them teaching pods. And you're facilitating these to train and empower people on the job. What are learning pods, Dan?
Well, I came to the idea because originally I said, okay, I could create video online and post it and it goes on for hours and it's not interactive. And the first thing is I like the interactivity. To me, that's the most exciting, what you spontaneously come up with in the moment. You're feeding off people's questions. That's to me the real delight, the catnip of something like that. So that was not very appealing. Next thing is I start thinking about webinars. And I don't know about you, but I have participated in many webinars, and the number that I enjoyed would be, you know, less than five. I found way too often that the content wasn't that great, the person wasn't that well prepared, they weren't very lively, I didn't get a sense of community as to who else was on the call, I didn't see faces, and I like to see faces. You know, the whole thing was just not motivating whatsoever. So I didn't want to go that route. So I was already leaning toward this idea of six people. And one of the reasons I went to six people is a funny comment by Tom Peters who said a team, a work team, should be no larger than who can be fed with two large pizzas. And that makes a lot of sense to me. You want some intimacy or huddling around that pizza in that case. But if you get too large of a group, I don't think it works. And there was a study that suggested that if you're listening to somebody, you want to be no more than 5 feet from the listener. Well, it turns out you could only get seven people around a table within 5 foot diameter of a speaker. And seven's actually already too big because with seven people, you've got 21 different relationships going on. If you get it down to six people, you've already dropped that to 15. So I, granted, I would be the seventh person as the leader, but I wanted something that was relatively intimate and had a chance for community.
You're describing what in my mind, I used to call a core group, which is not one or two other people, but enough that you get some variety and thought leadership, but not so much that two-thirds of the group doesn't participate.
Yeah. I mean, we've all sat in staff meetings where most of the people are just campers. I mean, they're just right there. They don't participate. It's a terrible waste of their time, and it doesn't make you feel close to the other people because there's just too many people around. If you look at human history, for 99% of human history, we have functioned in really small groups, little mini tribes, the family, the extended family, 10 to 50 people, but often on the short end of that scale. And I really wanted to pull it back in that kind of direction because my thought is, sure, I'm happy to be the guide, but I want people to learn from each other. Right. I want the interactivity. And I thought with six people, there's a chance that you create a sense of community that could even outlive the podcast. I mean, not the podcast, the episode, the learning pod.
Right.
They could stay with each other. They could stay connected, that the learning doesn't have to end at the end of the 45-minute session. To me, that would really be exciting.
as you're talking, I'm thinking about the last conversation we had, and we talked about focus groups. And I've never been a big fan for the simple reason that I've never been in a focus group, and I've attended many. I've never been in one where ideas actually get created. If a focus group has a lot of people in it, I think it tends to kill good ideas. I'm excited about a six-person group for the very reason that you just said, because any more than that, then somebody's going to feel intimidated by maybe some of the alphas in the group and say, all right, let them talk. I'm not going to participate. But if it's a smaller, more intimate group, that person's thought leadership becomes integral. What are your thoughts?
I think one of the reasons focus groups don't work is you've got your discussion guide where the client hammered you and said, you got to cover these 40 questions in 45 minutes. And you can almost sense the guide, the moderator, just plowing through the discussion guide. My idea was I limited it to 4 slides. There's an opening kind of teaser slide and 3 follow-ons, and that's it. So there's no way in the world that I am going to dominate the 45 minutes based on, you know, a rehearsed presentation. I want to be kind of feeding little things out there to give some guidance to it. But that's as far as I want to go. I don't want to be the dominant person. I want the people to play off each other. And I'm not a fan of focus groups. I can think of a focus group I once observed for Campbell Soup where everybody in the group hated the moderator. It was really hard to facially code because every time she asked a question, they like sneered at her. And then, you know, they kind of would subside into the question itself a moment later, but they just detested the woman who was pretty highfalutin and from the West Coast, and they were lower middle class Americans from the Jersey Shore and Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. They just did not relate to this woman whatsoever.
We've been rewired by this pandemic, and in one respect, I think we're going to be depending more on Zoom to do our work because it's sort of where we're going.
Yep.
The concept of the office, I don't know what's going to happen to office environments, at least in the short term, because there's so much uncertainty. We're not going to have a reliable vaccine probably for another 12 to 18 months. Ergo, we're going to still be working at home. And the interaction that you and I are having on Zoom is going to be more than normal. That's why I'm excited about this learning pod idea that you have, because companies still need to be vital. They still need to create new ideas and new revenue streams and new products to solve problems. In a larger Zoom group environment, you're spending so much time saying, hey, George, mute your microphone.
Yes.
Whereas in this environment, I feel like there's some cohesion.
Yes. And my goal would be, you know, for instance, that you might rotate who asked the questions. We could even agree on an agenda beforehand, some things we know we want to hit, and move that around. I don't have to be the person who leads every point in the discussion. If you can signal other voices have authority, I think that would be great and it should be where the workplace is going. I totally agree with you, things are going to change. Just this morning, the New York Times had a piece about workers, despite the fact that New York City is quote unquote back open for business. Most of those office buildings are not full. They're not even close to full. And it could be, as you said, a long time. And I'm not sure it's ever going to be ever again quite the way it was. So Zoom, maybe occasionally Teams get together in a really safe, masked, 6 feet apart sort of way to have some sense of in-person camaraderie. But I'm not sure that's terribly feasible. Maybe it's more small group. It's one-on-one, two-on-ones. It's people creating Instagram and video blogging, trying to forge connections and move forward on projects. I think it's going to be a really different mode than we've had before. It's not going to be a top-down micromanagement kind of environment. I don't think that's going to work.
So you have a team of about 6. What does that do to cohesion? Are we able then to relate to each other better and call out something that's, you know, discordant or say, you know, I really like that idea? Why is this better in your mind?
Well, because I think you can get a sense of the personalities, their biases, what's their interests. Because if people get to ask a follow-on question and they can actually have enough space, and I chose 45 minutes because I wanted people to get out in the hour and get ready for their next call or event in their day. But I didn't want to make it as little as 30 minutes. I just didn't think you could get into the back and forth and the drill downs and the follow-up to explore something. And so that's why I settled on that time frame. And one of the funny things is, I'd pretty much already gone there, but I had on my podcast Nick Morgan, who's published a book called Can You Hear Me? And I said, you know, just kind of threw it out there. I said, so what do you think would be a great size for a group online? And immediately he said 6 people. I mean, he didn't hesitate for a moment. He didn't say 7 or 5 or 10. It was 6 people. And we commiserated about the awfulness of webinars. And to me, the webinar is totally a one-way street. And you're right, there is no cohesion on a webinar. I've never sensed any community whatsoever. I really want this to be like a, you know, a band on stage that is, you know, playing off each other's leads and ideas. To me, that would be what's exciting.
The one sector of the economy, of the service economy, that I think is most worrisome is the meetings and conference sector.
Yes.
Before the plague descended upon us in early March, I attended a podcasting convention in Florida, in Orlando, that had about 1,800 people. And the plenary was a big room and lots of cheering and everything. Are those days over? Is the idea of going to a conference going to change because we're so skittish about being around each other because of this pandemic?
Well, yeah, you're right that a vaccine's not coming anytime soon. In all probability, not one we can trust. I'm not going to probably take Putin's vaccine. I'm not planning to fly to Moscow this weekend to take that. I don't know. I'm a little different animal perhaps than some people. I would welcome being in person. I like the buzz, the energy of the room. You know, are all the conferences going to survive? Are the budgets going to go down as well as the savings that companies reap from maybe not releasing the same office space or not as much of it? I mean, I can see all sorts of casualties of a down economy that could take a while to recover from. You know, I just was looking at a chart the other day for the Great Recession. We didn't get back to a reasonable degree of unemployment for 5 years after 2008.
Right.
So we're deeper than the deepest point of the 2008 recession in terms of unemployment level. So, geez, this could be 5 years. This could be 7 years. That's a long time. However it struggles back into existence, I will welcome it. But I would say one thing there. I would love for those conferences to come to some sense of intimacy that I think they don't have. Some of the big events and people on stage and the energy of the larger room is great. Mm-hmm. But a series of droning presentations is not what I'm advocating for from the stage. And I'm not really a big fan of the 10-minute little mini bursts either. I don't think you get into very much. I can tell you the one thing that I always wanted to see at a conference and never did, no one dared do it, was an honest debate where two people had different methodologies, different viewpoints, a slight moderator perhaps, or a panel moderator, but essentially people were allowed to go at it on stage, which took the risk that you could lose the verbal fight. But I thought that would actually be exciting. I wanted Ali versus Frazier. I never saw that at a conference. And I mentioned that because one alternative to focus groups that a client was doing in one case, which I loved, was three doctors and the moderator played a really reduced role. And essentially the three doctors fought with each other or which claims they thought, you know, were of value regarding the new drug, what its real efficacy is going to be, what imagery might work. But it was largely a conversation between them with the moderator no longer a moderator, but more like a referee in a boxing ring. And that was exciting. And the doctors liked it because they could intellectually step forward and not just be spoon-fed the questions.
Well, I would love to see that. I have a background in politics. And back in the day when I was running a local committee, I went to the opposing side and said to this gentleman, let's do a Lincoln-Douglas-style debate at the public library. And at first he thought it was a great idea. Yeah, let's do it. 2 weeks later, he got fired. Somebody else came in and the guy never spoke to me. And I think that's a scary thing for some people. They don't want to be shown that they're wrong. I would rather have the debate and make my ideas stronger. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, take it on. You might lose or you might lose some portions of the debate or so on. But to me, it's like writing a book. I mean, writing a book is really humbling. You write something, you think it's pretty good. You look at it the next morning and go, oh God, 2/3 of that has to go. Well, the same thing could happen for you in a debate. Not only what you're hearing from the other side, but how the audience is reacting. You're going to learn what things are relevant, what things maybe don't hold water, but it is a learning experience and there's an excitement to it being unrehearsed. Probably rather scary for his bandmates, but I know that Bob Dylan, when he records, pretty much just they come into the room, the hired musicians, and he doesn't really tell them what key it's even in. He just kind of like starts in on the song, and they try to figure out how it's going. And he doesn't like more than two or three takes, and that's going to be it. And they better be damn good, because they're going to have to get the swing fast. But I think it also keeps them on their toes and keeps them from just putting in a rote performance.
And Bob Dylan produced Blood on the Tracks, which is one of my favorite albums. And it was just phenomenal.
It's a great, great album. Yes.
So, future of work. I think the current political environment, depending upon how things turn out, may actually force us to be more collaborative and really think more about ideas. And I think this idea of learning pods will help to flesh out some ideas that have been either undeveloped or sort of hidden under a rock somewhere. So I'm really, really excited about that. What aspects do you think things like that are going to impact the future of work, Dan?
Well, to me, it organically fits with where I think work is going to go. Back in 2003, Tom Peters in Reimagine said 99% of middle managers should get fired, let go. You know, that's Tom's way of always going out there to the utter edge of something. But I think if they're not fired, I think 99% of managers should be thinking about their jobs differently than right now. I mean, I'll start with one really key statistic. Two of the guests of my podcast on subsequent weeks said that about 20 to 25% of all bosses are bullies.
Yeah.
What are the odds that bullies are getting good work out of people? You grind people down. My idea of a learning pod is really organically in keeping with that notion. But I'd love to step back and be a little more the guide and the referee than the moderator and the dictator of the session. And I think bosses should be the same thing. They're going to have to start thinking about how they really do something that adds value. I had three bosses in larger business settings before I started my company. One of them was fabulous. She was the daughter of a former governor of New Jersey. Just a wonderful person. I adored going to work for her. Would have gone to the ends of the earth for her. But the other two bosses, one was just kind of skating through and one was a terrorist. So they offered no value. They were counter value. So how do you provide yourself as a mentor, a setup artist for these teams? You know, we could be forming teams and reforming teams. I see it as a very different community going forward where there's not a mayor of the town so much as there's a city council and it's these little teams or pods that can work together.
You mentioned the bully aspect. And I actually think that's something where the future of work is really going to be impacted. We don't want to work for bullies. We want to do right and do well. And I think really good managers are going to manage the output and not the people. We're going to get away from this idea that I've got headcount under me and the power that it gives us. We're going to be rewarded for doing good work, moving the needle in the right direction, and giving our people the tools they need to succeed in their own right. I think we're going to get to that point, and I think the pandemic and our political situation has made us so weary that we want to have things that are better. I think we're going to shift in that direction.
Well, we are as a society, I mean, going through so many issues right now, not just COVID-19 and the political election and Black Lives Matter, but obviously, you know, where the environment is headed. I've read things that suggest we're going to get more pandemics. So I think we do have to try to pull together, and I'm kind of a jaded optimist, but I remain an optimist, and I want to think that we can learn from each other and move things forward. I think a lot of bosses, yes, I can think of a sales meeting that I attended because it was a business ally in Philadelphia. Mm. It was a rote meeting going through the status of how was everyone's sales pipeline. There was no energy in the room. People threw out the usual excuses or so on. Just the other day, someone was talking to me about what I actually do in my meetings for the sales team. If they can give that to me on a piece of paper, let's not waste the time going over that. Let's talk about how I can teach you or inform you, or we can inform each other about how you handle a certain situation, a certain person, a certain kind of buyer. That's that cross-learning that I think makes it much more exciting for people. And that's part of why I think, yeah, the manager's role to me is fundamentally ready to change. Should have changed already, certainly should change now. that Gallup poll, the last one done on engagement in the workplace. My God, 66% or whatever of people merely present. About 18% of people actively disengaged from work, and less than a quarter of the people actively engaged at work. Who wants to run a factory in this day and age when you're trying to be profitable, where two-thirds of the place is basically shut down?
Right, right. And that's on my homepage of my website, because that's the dumpster fire that we're dealing with right now. Two-thirds of us are to some degree disengaged at work. That's an endemic. That's not even a pandemic. It's an endemic. And we've got to solve it.
Yeah, and the HR department hasn't historically intervened for these bully bosses and these situations where there's no energy in the department. The executives are off to lunch or cashing in their stock bonuses, or I'm not sure what they're doing. But yeah, people should be intervening and changing these things. It's not like I love Jack Welch, you know, top to bottom, but there were some really interesting things he did at GE. One of them is he actually spent, I think, north of 80% of his time reviewing talent, trying to understand what was really going on, what was the pulse of the organization. So that was reviews of key personnel, done offsite, day-long conversations with just two or three people in the room, so quite an intimate conversation, or was in what he called, I think, the pit in the learning center where people could feed questions and there was conversation back and forth electronically and verbally. Those kinds of things, I think, can set people on fire versus what happens right now with a lot of slumbering.
You mentioned Tom Peters, one of my favorite business authors. He wrote In Search of Excellence. I wonder what he thinks of the new paradigm, because he wrote In Search of Excellence probably late 70s, early 80s, when business was a mess. It was a disorganized mess. Labor was a mess. It was expensive. It was not well managed and not well guided. I mean, a lot of things have changed in the workforce now in the ways that we do things. I would love to see what he's saying about this new paradigm of work that we're in right now and how we can make it even better.
Well, in 2006, seven, somewhere in there, I was actually invited along some other thought leaders to his farmhouse up in Vermont and an offsite. It was fellow authors, CEOs, so on. And Tom was, you know, just coming off Reimagine. And that book is multicolor. It is a crazy, highly energetic book. And it completely saw where I think we could be and should be and will be heading ultimately, that things were going to get blown up, revisited, that the old top-down sort of structure wasn't going to survive very well. And you just had to liberate people. He was all about talent. And yeah, that word can get jaded, but it's still an interesting concept that we've moved along beyond the employee, the colleague. Those are pretty drab words, kind of like, you know, cubicles that are mouse gray and turd brown. Talent, at least, is a term that I can get a bit excited about. And it really speaks to people's potential. And that's what keeps Tom going, is potential. So I've emailed with Tom within the last month or two. And he's creating videos and writing stuff still. Tom will not go gently into that good night.
Oh, very good. That is exciting. I'd love to meet him someday.
he is so high energy. It's crazy almost.
So let's talk something fun. Let's talk about your latest project that you've been working on. It's called The Devil's Dictionary of Work Life. What is that, Dan?
Well, I am a longtime fan of The Devil's Dictionary by Ambrose Bierce. He was a contemporary of Mark Twain. The Devil's Dictionary's diabolical definitions like bore, someone who talks when you want him to listen, deal, a nervous disorder that afflicts the young and the inexperienced. There are all of these wonderful definitions in the book. It's been voted one of the top 100 pieces of American literature all time. And as many times as I've moved in life and had to shed books and records and simplify to move from one city or state to another, I always kept the copy of the Devil's Dictionary that I bought. So what happened was I had 2 weeks in a row, I had guests on who cited this statistic that about 20 to 25% of bosses are bullies. And about a week after the second one of these, I woke up 4:30 in the morning and said, I've got to write a Devil's Dictionary of Work Life, because this thing should be lampooned. We are living with these buzzwords, these cliches, these sayings that really reveal to us that the work life is not optimal. We're not realizing our potential. And satire can be, you know, first of all, I love humor, but satire can also be a way of lampooning things and saying, you know, let's reform, let's improve things. So it's written in that kind of spirit.
And when will it be out?
Well, that will depend on the publishing world, which, you know, is a 19th century industry. I'm moving as fast as I can, at least. They never seem to move fast. Howard Moskowitz wrote so many contributions that I made him a co-author, but I have over 50 other people who have contributed, including yourself. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
At least one term, and some people, my God, you know, came back with 10, 20, 30. Howard came back with probably 300 to 400. And I said, well, you know, this book is about injustices, and it would be an injustice not to make you a co-author. So right. Would you please accept? And he said, sure, I'd be happy to. I love the Devil's Dictionary. I will be done with the definitions themselves and culling and refining them. But I'm going to also add in something you don't have on the Devil's Dictionaries. I want to go through and actually analyze these terms that we bandy around in business. For instance, I can already tell that it's striking how many had to do with violence, essentially. I mean, you could start with the term deep six an idea, which makes you think you're working for a funeral parlor or you're part of the mafia. But we have so many terms that tell you the psychological violence that I think people go through, that they're not sure about their job, they feel shut down, they feel hammered by a boss, all these ways in which it's not a comfortable environment. And when you're not comfortable, you don't learn, and you're not inquisitive, and you don't lean in, because why would you lean in just to get punched? Exactly. Nobody's going to bother to do that.
Exactly. Dr. Dan Hill, always a delight. We love having you on the tightrope. For our listeners who aren't familiar with you and want to learn more, where on social media would you point them?
Oh, well, I think you could go to my website, because you get the obligatory 3 W's, and sensorylogic.com, and you're going to see the Twitter handle and all the other stuff out there. You can also find it pretty easily, though, by going to a blog that I publish every week called Faces of the Week. And I'm delighted to say that Flipboard, which goes through and culls what they think are the best blogs, I think in the last 7 weeks, they've featured me like 5 times. At least one of those was thanks to an idea that you threw out to me. So thank you very much for that. But there you can find all the social media connections, basically.
Yeah, my contribution to you was the many faces of Bill Belichick.
yes, which was fabulous, because he's actually both a good boss and a bad boss.
Right.
And I think that made it more intriguing. You also gave me the mock home workstation for the mother who's having a glass of wine while her daughter's playing on the ground below her.
Yeah, we also featured my daughter, who did a bunch of different faces, and I arrayed them in Hollywood Squares tiles, and you actually decoded her facial expressions. I turned that into a birthday present for her. That's a t-shirt that she wears.
Oh, well, that's great.
So people will say, okay, how is she today, and where on the shirt can I decode her? Dr. Dan Hill, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. It's a blast to talk to you.
Links to Dr. Dan Hill's social media are provided in the show notes for this episode at dansmolin.com. Please join us again for more inspiring stories from people who walk the tightrope to seek and do meaningful work. You can subscribe to us where you get your podcasts, or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmolin.com. I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Tightrope Podcast. Together, let's walk the tightrope to find and do meaningful work. For the future of work is meaningful work. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week.